With his eyes still in his coat pockets, he stalked by me into the hall, turned sharply as if he were on the wire, and disappeared into the living room. It wasn't a bit funny. Aware of the loud beating of my own heart, I pulled the door to against the increasing rain. For half a minute, there wasn't a sound. Then, from the living room, I heard a sort of choking murmur and part of a laugh followed by Daisy's voice on a clear, artificial note. "I certainly am awfully glad to see you again." A pause. It endured horribly. I had nothing to do in the hall, so I went into the room. Gatsby, his hands still in his pockets, was reclining against the mantelpiece in a strained counterfeit of perfect ease, even of boredom. His head leaned back so far that it rested against the face of a defunct mantelpiece clock, and from this position his distraught eyes stared down at Daisy, who was sitting frightened but graceful on the edge of a stiff chair. "We've met before," muttered Gatsby. His eyes glanced momentarily at me, and his lips parted with an abortive attempt at a laugh. Luckily, the clock took this moment to tilt dangerously at the pressure of his head, whereupon he turned and caught it with trembling fingers and set it back in place. Then he sat down, rigidly, his elbow on the arm of the sofa and his chin in his hand. "I'm sorry about the clock," he said. My own face had now assumed a deep tropical burn. I couldn't muster up a single commonplace out of the thousand in my head. "It's an old clock," I told him idiotically. I think we all believed for a moment that it had smashed in pieces on the floor. "We haven't met for many years," said Daisy, her voice as matter-of-fact as it could ever be.
5 years next November."
The automatic quality of Gatsby's answer set us all back at least another minute. I had them both on their feet with the desperate suggestion that they help me make tea in the kitchen when the demoniac Finn brought it in on a tray. Amid the welcome confusion of cups and cakes, a certain physical decency established itself. Gatsby got himself into a shadow, and while Daisy and I talked, looked conscientiously from one to the other of us with tense and happy eyes. However, as calmness wasn't an end in itself, I made an excuse at the first possible moment and got to my feet. "Where are you going?" demanded Gatsby in immediate alarm. "I'll be back. I've got to speak to you about something before you go." He followed me wildly into the kitchen, closed the door, and whispered, "Oh, God," in a miserable way. "What's the matter?" "This is a terrible mistake," he said, shaking his head from side to side. "A terrible, terrible mistake."
"You're just embarrassed, that's all."
"And luckily," I added, "Daisy's embarrassed, too."
"She's embarrassed?" he repeated incredulously. "Just as much as you are."
"Don't talk so loud."
"You're acting like a little boy," I broke out impatiently.
"Not only that, but you're rude. Daisy's sitting in there all alone." He raised his hand to stop my words, looked at me with unforgettable reproach, and opening the door cautiously, went back into the other room. I walked out the back way, just as Gatsby had when he had made his nervous circuit of the house half an hour before, and ran for a huge black knotted tree whose massed leaves made a fabric against the rain. Once more it was pouring, and my irregular lawn, well shaved by Gatsby's gardener, abounded in small muddy swamps and prehistoric marshes. There was nothing to look at from under the tree except Gatsby's enormous house, so I stared at it, like Kant at his church steeple, for half an hour. A brewer had built it early in the period craze, a decade before, and there was a story that he'd agreed to pay 5 years' taxes on all the neighbouring cottages if the owners would have their roofs thatched with straw. Perhaps their refusal took the heart out of his plan to found a family. He went into an immediate decline. His children sold his house with the black wreath still on the door. Americans, while occasionally willing to be serfs, have always been obstinate about being peasantry. After half an hour, the sun shone again, and the grocer's automobile rounded Gatsby's drive with the raw material for his servant's dinner. I felt sure he wouldn't eat a spoonful. A maid began opening the upper windows of his house, appeared momentarily in each, and leaning from a large central bay, spat meditatively into the garden. It was time I went back. While the rain continued, it had seemed like the murmur of their voices, rising and swelling a little,
now and then, with gusts of emotion. But in the new silence, I felt that silence had fallen within the house, too. I went in, after making every possible noise in the kitchen short of pushing over the stove, but I don't believe they heard a sound. They were sitting at either end of the couch, looking at each other as if some question had been asked or was in the air, and every vestige of embarrassment was gone. Daisy's face was smeared with tears, and when I came in, she jumped up and began wiping at it with her handkerchief before a mirror. But there was a change in Gatsby that was simply confounding. He literally glowed. Without a word or a gesture of exultation, a new well-being radiated from him and filled the little room. "Oh, hello, old sport," he said, as if he hadn't seen me for years. I thought for a moment he was going to shake hands. "It's stopped raining, has it?" When he realized what I was talking about, that there were twinkle bells of sunshine in the room, he smiled like a weatherman, like an ecstatic patron of recurrent light, and repeated the news to Daisy. "What do you think of that? It's stopped raining." "I'm glad, Jay." Her throat, full of aching, grieving beauty, told only of her unexpected joy. "I want you and Daisy to come over to my house," he said. "I'd like to show her around." "You're sure you want me to come?" "Absolutely, old sport." Daisy went upstairs to wash her face. Too late, I thought, with humiliation of my towels, while Gatsby and I waited on the lawn. "My house looks well, doesn't it?" he demanded. "See how the whole front of it catches the light?" I agreed that it was splendid. "Yes," his eyes went over it, "every arched door and square tower. It took me just 3 years to earn the money that bought it." "I thought you inherited your money." "I did, old sport," he said automatically, "but I lost most of it in the big panic, the panic of the war." I think he hardly knew what he was saying, for when I asked him what business he was in, he answered, "That's my affair," before he realized that it wasn't the appropriate reply. "Oh, I've been in several things," he corrected himself. "I was in the drug business, and then I was in the oil business, but I'm not in either one now." He looked at me with more attention. "Do you mean you've been thinking over what I proposed the other night?" Before I could answer, Daisy came out of the house, and two rows of brass buttons on her dress gleamed in the sunlight. "That huge place there?" she cried, pointing. "Do you like it?" "I love it, but I don't see how you live there all alone." "I keep it always full of interesting people, night and day. People who do interesting things, celebrated people." Instead of taking the shortcut along the sound, we went down the road and entered by the big postern. With enchanting murmurs, Daisy admired this aspect or that of the feudal silhouette against the sky, admired the gardens, the sparkling odour of jonquils, and the frothy odour of hawthorn and plum blossoms, and the pale gold odour of kiss me at the gate. It was strange to reach the marble steps and find no stir of bright dresses in and out the door, and hear no sound but bird voices in the trees. And inside, as we wandered through Marie Antoinette music rooms and restoration salons, I felt that there were guests concealed behind every couch and table, under orders to be breathlessly silent until we had passed through. As Gatsby closed the door of the Merton College Library, I could have sworn I heard the owl-eyed man break into ghostly laughter.